The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2011 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2011. If you have purchased this audio CD, you are free to make multiple copies of it for your own or your school's use. You may not sell copies of this audio or post it on the Internet. If you would like to find out more about the work of ACCS, please visit our website at www.accsedu.org. To order additional talks from this conference, please visit the ACCS website and click on Conferences. Thank you for your support of ACCS.
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that. Thank you.
Thank you and good morning. I'm so glad these big screens are not on. I feel like if they were, I'd have to make some sort of an announcement. My fellow Americans, on this day, I would like to announce that, yes, I am running. Actually, I ran this morning. It's 3 miles. It's a little muggy, but it was great. Good morning. My name is George, and I'm serving you today. I'll be taking care of you. Well, as you can see, I'm going to, in this talk, spend a little bit of time in the Old Testament, and in particular, to that wondrous passage in Deuteronomy 6, required reading and required understanding for those of us who have entered into the task of classical and Christian education. But before we actually get to Deuteronomy 6, and I do encourage you to have your Bibles out because we'll work through the passage, but I want to tell you a little story about one of my heroes, Jean-Henri Merle d'Aubigné. He was born in 1794 into a noble Huguenot family in exile in Geneva for several generations. And he was the scion of this grand clan and grew up in the reformed environs of Geneva and went to the Genevan Academy, where when he was a teenager, for the first time, actually heard the gospel. Because like all battles, the battle for the Reformation is a battle that never stays won. The fact is that the Genevan church had wandered far from its halcyon days under Calvin and Beza, and had long been ensnared in a kind of Unitarian deism. The gospel flame had flickered almost altogether out. When Robert Haldane came to the city, a Scottish evangelist, he began to hold a number of meetings, and young d'Aubigné was among the attendees, and he heard the gospel afresh, and he made connections from his academic background and was astonished that he was being shown his own inheritance for the first time. He very quickly became a dynamic advocate of the gospel, and when he had graduated from the academy, ventured out into Europe to explore further education. He found himself in Berlin in 1817 amongst the Huguenot exiles there. And it struck him that it was the tercentenary of the Reformation itself, and made plans to go to Wittenberg for the grand celebration, and there heard things about the Reformation that he had never heard before and was certain that no one else had either, and determined at that moment as a young man that he would spend the rest of his life documenting the history of the Reformation. And thus began a remarkable lifelong pursuit that produced some of the most helpful and to this day readable histories of that whole era. Without d'Aubigné's work, our understanding of the Reformation would be poor indeed. Over the course of the next several years, he served as a pastor in Hamburg and in Brussels. But following the Belgian Revolution of 1830, though he was closely connected to the court of William of Orange, he decided to return to Geneva, where he hoped to begin to train young men for the work of Reformed ministry in his own hometown, where that work had been abandoned for more than two generations. And so he opened a little training school. And the training school became the foundation of the Lille Réveillée, the great revival of the 19th century, and ultimately gave rise to some of the most remarkable Reformed minds of the day, including Groen van Prinsterer, who was the mentor to Abraham Kuyper. Daubigné became a friend and an advocate of Thomas Chalmers in Scotland, and he became an engine of productivity and innovation in the life of the church. But most of all, he was just training young men for the work of the ministry. He began every one of his classes in the same way, taking for his cue the great Shema passage from Deuteronomy 6. He would walk into his classroom and stand before his students. The first few years, he never had more than 11 students. When he finally got a class of 12, he rejoiced mightily. It was 5.5 years into his enterprise. But always he began with these words, Shama Israel, Yehovah Elohim, Yehovah Echad. Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God is one. Rather strange words, many thought, for a Reformed training ground. After all, the Shema passage of Deuteronomy 6, verse 4, is the first phrase uttered by the observant Jews twice a day in their course of prayers. It formed the basis for the coherence of the Jewish community, and by the time Daubigné adopted this, it was the heart cry of many in the Zionist movement, newly emerged. Nevertheless, Daubigné believed that in this little passage was what he called the great worldview declaration of the Old Testament. In it, he saw the foundations of the doctrine of the Trinity, the threefold invocation of God's name and the persistent use of plural nouns and verbs, shouted from the Old Testament into the New. Our God is Father, Son, and Spirit, three in one and one in three. In it, he also saw a clear and comprehensive pedagogy for Christian discipleship. In it, he found the distinctive presuppositions necessary for a Christian theory of knowledge or epistemology. In it, he discerned a strategy for the reformation of a culture, for the perpetuation of genuine covenantal succession. In it, he discovered the real secret behind the ideas of Beza in Geneva and Melanchthon in Wittenberg and Bucer in Strasbourg and Cranmer in Canterbury. In it, he saw the foundations that had been laid by Comenius and would be laid by Chalmers and De Prinsterer and Kuyper. In other words, he saw in this passage a kind of comprehensive declaration for how we ought to go about what we go about. He believed that ultimately, if a church, a school, a people, a covenant community is to be successful in inculcating the truth in a culture, we can't simply assume the posture of excellent methodologies or fine curricula standards or accelerated academics or the fine cultural applications. There needs to be this kind of comprehensive vision found in the Shema. The passage declares quite famously, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one. And you shall love the Lord your God with all of your heart, with all of your soul, and with all of your might. And these words that I command you today shall be on your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children and shall talk of them when you sit in your house and when you walk by the way and when you lie down and when you rise up. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand and they shall be as frontlets between your eyes and you shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates. Now when the Lord your God brings you into the land that he swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to give you great and good cities that you did not build, and houses full of good things that you did not fill, and cisterns that you did not dig, and vineyards and olive trees that you did not plant. And when you are able to eat and are full, then take care that you do not forget the Lord your God. You shall not put the Lord your God to the test. You shall diligently keep the commandments of the Lord your God. You shall do what is right and good and true in the sight of the Lord, that all may go well with you. And then, verse 20, in times to come, when your son shall come to you and ask you, oh, what do these mean, these commandments and statutes and laws? Then you shall say to your son, let me tell you a story. That is the Shema. For Daubigny, the Shema strategy was to recognize that what we are about as we disciple the generations, as we prepare the next generation, as we inculcate in them truth and goodness, is not a simple, straightforward educational task. Instead, there are certain biases that we must bring to the task. Presuppositional notions that are unique in the world, that sound to the tin ear of the world, altogether off note. Have you seen the new Dr. Pepper commercials? It's a campaign to try and describe what it is that Dr. Pepper tastes like. Some poor on-the-street fellow is cornered and he's given a sip of Dr. Pepper and they say, what does that taste like? And they go, well, it's a kind of, it's got this sort of, thing that is like, it tastes like Dr. Pepper. In a sense, that sort of dissonance ought to ring in our heads every time somebody says to us, what is classical Christian education? I mean, it's not regular education plus something. In our town, they think it's a school for smart kids who play violin or oboe. It In fact, it's of an altogether different order of things. To try and describe what classical Christian education is in comparison to almost any other education falls flat. It's why we have to have, like D'Aubigny, a firm grasp of the Schema strategy. See, in this Schema declaration, there is a beginning point. And the beginning point is the recognition that all knowledge only becomes actual knowledge in light of the truth that there is a God, that He is sovereign, that He exercises His defined and purposeful decrees in the world according to His divine prerogative, that this sovereign God is the one true God and the beginning point of all truth. You have folks in your community who want to start classical schools, but without any theological reference whatsoever. Okay, so read some Plato. That's great. That's not classical education. Okay, so you're going to have rhetoric classes. Grand, wonderful. You'll have articulate lost kids. What the Schema strategy begins with is the fact that the Lord our God, is one. And you shall love the Lord your God with all of your heart, with all of your soul, and with all of your might. The curriculum in math, the curriculum in science, the curriculum in rhetoric, in Latin, in anything apart from this is hollow. It doesn't meet the standard. I think a lot of us worry so much about the standards that we forget about the foundation that the standards stand upon. I'm oftentimes about this time of year asked by moms and dads, okay, we want to start a reading program with our kids. They've been reading this really hefty stuff all year, and now dad or mom wants to spend some time and just delight in some literature. What are the books that we should read? They want a list from me. And, of course, they usually get a list. I love lists. But I'm almost Aristotelian in that regard. I love lists. But the problem is, and I always tell them this, it really doesn't matter all that much what you read. It's that you read. It's that time that you set aside. Read Jemima Puddle Duck, for heaven's sakes. And after all, there are a lot worse things that you can read besides Jemima Puddle Duck. In Jemima Puddle Duck, you actually have all of the consistent aspects that are necessary for a strong narrative, for a good novel. Go back and read Jemima Puddle Duck. It's great. But the point is read anything, but read it all through the lens of this great and glorious truth. There is God. He is sovereign and we are not. He has brought redemption, and that makes all the difference. We do not need better educated pagans in the world. We do not need to take our covenant children and drive them to distraction from the things that matter most. The Schema strategy begins with a theological bias that everything in the curriculum redounds to the praise and the glory of the Most High God. Here, the phrase of Abraham Kuyper rings so very true. There is not one square inch in the whole domain of human existence over which Christ, who is sovereign over all, does not say, mine. Mine. That's where the Shema strategy begins. And that's where we must begin. Despite the fact that the state legislators pushing through the new charter schools programs want us to take everything but this, despite the fact that there are moms and dads in our communities who would love to do what we're doing if we weren't so terribly sectarian, despite the fact that all of the signs of our culture point in the opposite direction, the fact is the Lord our God is one, and that is the starting place. But notice that the Shema strategy also puts a strong emphasis on something terribly antiquarian and out of sorts in our digital age. The Shema strategy declares a theological bias and then quickly runs to a literary bias. Did you notice that? It is words. The words that the Lord God, who is sovereign, has commanded us that shall be on our heart. It is words that we are to teach diligently to our children. It's words that we're to talk about when we sit in the house and when we walk by the way and when we lie down and when we rise up. There is a remarkable logocentric nature to truth. It's the means by which God reveals himself to man. It is the means by which his character and nature and attributes are unfolded to us. The Bible is full of stories, not just didactae. This past week, I had the opportunity to be a part of a radio forum where we were talking about the difference between Islam and Christianity. And, of course, there are all kinds of sociological differences and economic differences and political differences, because Islam is, first and foremost, an ideology. Like Marxism, it's a philosophy like that of Heidegger's, and it's almost as difficult to read the Quran as it is to read Heidegger. And part of the reason that it's difficult is that it is a whole series of discourses with no stories. No narrative flow. It's not linear. It doesn't begin at a place and end at a place. There's not a straight line of logic, because those ideas, linear history, linear arguments, rationality, all emerge from the scriptures with words, stories, parables and sayings and riddles, history. It's full of the delight of the drama of human experience. It doesn't flash before us merely as a series of images, though there are moments when we're reading Ezekiel where we can't help but have a cinematic experience. But the fact is that there is a kind of literary bias in the revelation of God, his world, his character, and his nature. John Calvin made it plain that we can look at the world around us and misinterpret it badly because our senses are not to be trusted. We have, he said, purblind eyes, and we need the lens of the scriptures in order to make it clear. We need those words. Seth Godin, in his most recent book, Poke the Box, uses an illustration early on in the book to illustrate this truth. He quotes a study that was done by the Max Planck Center for Biological Studies, in which they measured what it is that people do when they are completely lost. I'm talking lost in the woods, lost in the Sahara Desert. And the study found universal conformity to this particular standard. If the North Star is out of sight, if you cannot see the sun rise, then every single human being does exactly the same thing. They walk in circles. Try as they might to walk in a straight line, they can't. They're constitutionally incapable. As a result, the study, and Seth Godin, as a consequence, concludes human beings constitutionally need a map because we cannot trust our senses. They will always deceive us. Now, we know this because we know our own sin nature. What we think is right is usually the exact opposite, the Bible says, of what is true. There's a way that seems right to a man, but it's into the way of death. We have purblind eyes. Our hearts are deceitful and wicked above all things and beyond cure. But we need God's clear revelation in order to see the world. And so true knowledge begins with true revelation. But we're moving into a remarkable age in which education is being transformed before our eyes. Suddenly there are whole curriculum packages that are really built for the iPad or the iPhone. There's an app for that, is the clarion cry of development for our age. But it doesn't change the Shema strategy one bit. It is by words that the truth is revealed to us. You know, these are only endangered because the publishing model, the economic model foisted upon us by a few large companies has been broken for a very long time. You're talking to an author here. I know this. There's nothing wrong with the conveyance of words and stories. What we're to be about is to tell the stories, convey the truth, use words. There's also a didactic bias that is at the heart of the Shema strategy. This is one of the things that Daubigny recognized immediately. And that is that these words are to be taught. In fact, they are to be taught, according to Deuteronomy 6, diligently. This didactic bias assumes that students will not get the material they need simply by exposure, by osmosis, simply watching something or feeling something. The Hebrew words that are used here are words that literally mean laborious. They're words that mean hard labor. It's work to teach anything. It's hard work. It results in crumpled pillows, sobbing in the middle of the semester. It results in multiple breakdowns during thesis writing time. It brings on those harried visits with worried parents toward the end of the semester. That's what it takes. You're not off the mark. The crisis that you face at the end of every semester and certainly at the end of every year, where some parents come to you and they say, I just don't know if we can do this anymore. I don't know that we can make it. We're exhausted and the kids not getting enough sleep and they're up way too late and they don't have a life. That's what it's about. It's why we call it school. You know, we're always tempted to shy away from that, to dumb it down, to make it simpler, to have easier access gates. And yes, of course, we should always learn how to be better communicators and more effective teachers and better encouragers. We need to engage more thoroughly and bring the parents alongside so that they know how in those moments of crisis when the 14-year-old suddenly decides that his dream of being a veterinarian is out the window because of this math class and that math teacher. But the reality is it's supposed to be work. It's supposed to be hard work. It's supposed to wear us out. That tension is what makes us stronger and better. It's a reminder that we live in a fallen world, that all is not right, that there's not a magic wand or a silver bullet or a red pill or a blue pill. It's a reminder that the task that we are about requires a didactic bias. But, of course, the glorious thing is that the shame of strategy doesn't leave us alone. Calls us into a community, and we see that so clearly here in Deuteronomy chapter 6. This theological bias, this literary bias, this didactic bias is filtered through the glory of community. I have several thousand followers on Facebook. They're not my community. Some of you are among them. I like you a lot. But you're not my friends. Well, some of you are, but that's not community. I need flesh and blood. I need people who can look me in the eye, who know my story, who walk with me, who know my kids and my grandkids and who love them like they love me. I need the provocation of love and good deeds. I need to sweat alongside as we mow the widow next door's grass, as we sit in the hospital waiting rooms, either with hearts full of gladness or hearts full of grieving. But we need communities. That's why it's very plain that this theological, literary, and didactic bias is filtered through the idea of walking together, of sitting together. It doesn't say Starbucks here, but I can clearly extrapolate. It's talking about those seasons in life when we're unhurried and we can unpack ideas and we can wrestle with our hearts. That's what classical Christian education is. If you thought that it was a simple matter of finding the right curriculum and implementing it in your community and suddenly flocks of people would come, you're sadly mistaken. What you're called to do is know people, love people, invest in people, walk with people, die with people, and see what God will bring forth across the long span of years and miles. Of course, it's a beautiful thing that this community life that lives in light of hard work and lots of beautiful and wonderful words in revealing the one true sovereign God. That's why we have this aesthetic bias. You know, the Lord's holiness is beautiful. And as we walk out this life together, it will naturally adorn our lives. Now, from the houses that we live in to the clothes that we wear, the lives that we live. That's why the shame of strategy includes this integration into the most fundamental details of life. Daubigné said, here is where the Jews seem to both understand it and lose it simultaneously, because they turned this into literalistic ritual rather than into a literal integration in the wholeness of life. The words of God are to adorn everything, not just carved into the doorposts, but garlanding the doorposts. That it transforms every meal, every conversation into an opportunity for the beauty of holiness to emerge, for sanctification, for the give and take and tug and pull of life to emerge. The shame strategy is that classical Christian education is far more than what takes place in the classroom. It's the adorning of the whole of life with the fullness of the good news. Of course, the Shema strategy outlines specific ethical behavior in verses 10 through 19 of Deuteronomy chapter 6. There is a kind of ethical bias. We actually expect that because the gospel means something, the gospel will do something. In our hearts and our lives, It cleans our potty mouths and it scrubs our potty minds. It fills our filthy hearts with the fresh cleansing waters of hope and redemption. And as a result, it changes who we are and what we do. Suddenly, the commands of God become the delight of our hearts. Not simply a standard or a rule against which we are judged, but rather the fullness of our joy overflowing. Classical Christian education should not simply result in high SAT scores. Excellent ACT placements, great college admissions. Classical Christian education should change hearts and lives, and as a result, classical Christian education should change our culture and change our world. If we settle for anything less, we have settled for foolishness, emptiness. Oh, we should leave these halls with a burning fire in our guts, like Knox who said, "Give me Scotland or I die," or Kuyper who said, "Let every hamlet ring with the fullness of the good news of the gospel." We should go forth from this place and not simply be thinking of how on earth are we going to make the next budget? How in heaven's name am I going to control that one difficult teacher? Well, no, I mean those three difficult teachers. We should go forth with the abounding confidence that God is up to something, that His gospel will change lives and that it will make a difference. And the world will be changed. That's the Shema strategy. But notice this whole wonderful narrative ends on a grand high note. In verse 20, at the conclusion of this sort of glorious crescendo of purposefulness, Moses records this little dialogue. So what happens in times to come? When your son comes to you and says, "What is the meaning of these commands and statutes and laws that the Lord our God has commanded you?" And in that day, you shall say to your son, "We were once slaves, but are no more. We were once bound, but now we are free. Let me tell you the story of our wandering years in the desert, of our difficult years when there was not nothing to eat, of God's provision in manna, His direction at Sinai, His liberation at Jericho, his reproof at Ai, and his glorious renewal of covenant at Shechem. Oh, let me tell you a story. The whole Shema strategy really hinges on this. The God who is there and who is sovereign does reveal himself. And there are glorious words that describe this revealing. It requires a good deal of discipleship, of hard work, of didacte in order to grasp the fullness of these words. But fortunately, that has been filtered into the ordinary details of life and relationships. It's not abstract ideas. It's ideas that have to be hammered out as we deal with difficult people, some that we like, some that we don't like, some who have betrayed us, some who have undermined us, many who do not understand us. But it's there in the glories of the fractiousness of the real world that we live in that the wonder is revealed, that the beauty is portrayed, and where the best stories are told. Daubigné wrote an incredible library. But perhaps his greatest impact came not as he wrote and published the history of the Reformation, but as he inculcated a vision for a new Reformation, for a new generation, by telling those grand old stories in light of a sovereign God who is there, who has given us words, who has given us work, who has given us relationships, who has given us beauty, who has poured out redemption so that we can live it in this present day and look forward to the day in the future when our sons and daughters and grandsons and granddaughters shall stand on a firmer foundation than we ever have. We look forward to that day when we're not reinventing the wheel again. We look forward to that day when the Shema strategy has taken root and changed lives just as it did in the La Revelia of the 19th century and gave us leaders like Kuyper and Bavinck and Van Til and Schaeffer and you. Lay hold of the Shema strategy. Don't shy away a moment. Shema, Israel, Yehovah Elohim, Yehovah Echad. Amen. God bless you.